Ron, that was a great explanation of Galatians 3:28. Very helpful. I would like, if you would, to elaborate, if you would, on the curse of Galatians 3:16. Genesis 3:16, I'm sorry. I will greatly multiply your sorrow in conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be to your husband, and he shall rule over you. If you would you address each one of those statements in that verse? Just real briefly give a quick little explanation as to what each one of those items, how it is a curse.
Okay. In the first place, if it had been Galatians 3:16, I might have been able to do a better job. No, anyway. The first thing I want to point out is in Genesis 3:16, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. Now, the first thing is, let's notice that this is part of the curse. And that what we have with each aspect of the curse, we had something that was good, but due to sin and the consequences of sin, something that was good now has a negative effect on it. So that's one thing we want to remember. First, we're starting with something good, and then this what? This adds, okay. I'll greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. Now, I'll present a thought here, and there might be a difference of opinion, and that's all right. I think most of us, when we think of this, we just think of the physical childbearing. And I think the point here is, now in a world where the headship helpership has been violated, in a world where now there's the consequences of sin and evil, what's going to happen? Well, mothers are going to bear children, but now there'll be sorrow with their children that they would have never had before. And so I think this relates to the whole fact of the raising of children, and now in a world of sin, where once everything would have been so glorious and so beautiful, now there'll be turmoil, difficulty. That's a thought. Okay. If anybody want to respond, that's fine. But don't go.
Okay. There shall be. Is this basically saying that mothers will have sorrow in raising their children that they would not have had otherwise had sin not entered into the world? In other words, children are not going to listen to mama like they would have listened to dad.
I think this is more about the raising of the child than the birth of the child. Yes. That's my thought.
Okay, would you comment on the, your desire shall be to your husband
and he shall rule? I'll get there. I just wanted to give you a chance to come back on that other one. These next two, I may not give you a chance. No. Okay, now we have sin in the world. The headship-helpership relationship is corrupted. Okay? Now, thy desire shall be to thy husband. In a world where headship and helpership is corrupted, the submissive helper will want to do what? The submissive helper will want to rule. The submissive helper will want to lead. And when a submissive helper starts telling the one who's ahead, hey, you listen to me, what's the head going to do? Your desire will be to take the position of headship. And when you desire to take the position of headship, the one who's going to be in the headship, he's going to rule over you. He's going to push you down. That's how I understand that. Genesis chapter 4, verse 7 is parallel, if I remember, pretty much in grammar. When I use the word grammar, I have to look around at these fellows. Grammar to me used to be a graham cracker. So anyway, I've got to get help. In Genesis chapter 4 and verse 7, it reads in this fashion. It says there, "If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted. And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him." Now I know there's several thoughts here about the old restoration, sin offering, etc. But it seems basically he says to Cain, how come you're pouting? How come you're pouting? Don't you know that if you'll still do well, you can be accepted? But sin lies at the door, desires to have you, and you turn around and you rule over it. I think that's a parallel passage. That's the three parts I think you asked me to comment on, George.
Glenn Osmond.
In the material that I've read, you're absolutely right. The passage they use most to promote the elect, never mind, whatever it is, Galatians 3:28.
I understand that.
The equality there. But there, in books on marriage, I found that another passage has come to the top of this as well, and it's Ephesians 5 and 21. Just before he begins showing illustrations of wives, be subject to your own husbands. Husbands, love your wives, verse 25. Children, obey your parents, chapter 6, verse 1. Fathers, don't provoke your children, verse 4. Slaves, be obedient, verse 5, chapter 6, verse 5. And then masters, you know, chapter 6, verse 9. After listing all of these different relationships where you have a head and you have a servant, or you have a one who is submissive, but it's all prefaced, and one book in particular really just says, this is the way it's been, but here's the commandment I'm giving to you, Ephesians 5:21, be subject to one another. In other words, mutual subjection or mutual submission. I just wanted you to comment on did you find this passage being used more lately, or has it just been context?
I don't know. I haven't read a book in years, Glenn.
Oh, no, I'm kidding. Okay. Ephesians 6:21, and be subject to one another.
Right.
Mutual submission.
In the first place, you can't stick mutual on the word submission. Okay? That word for submission there, I can't say it. You fellows can. The whole point is that word is one directional. That word is a word of authority. Somebody is under somebody. All right? All right. Wife, you're under God and husband. Hubby, you have an employer and a boss over here, and you're under him. The idea of mutual submission is to whatever authority that's over you, you are to submit to. And it is not a reciprocal relationship. Pardon me for my lack of passages. But we can read passages that shows it's not a reciprocal relationship. So this verse is terribly abused, because when it says mutual submission, there is no such real relationship in that word from the term submission. Does that help?
Oh, I agree. I just wanted everybody to be aware that not only is Galatians used, but Ephesians 5:21 is used, but it has to be used out of context, because what follows are illustrations that you said. You're right, it doesn't work. Mutual submission does not work in all the examples that follow.
Yeah. Well, are parents going to submit to children? Exactly. Ephesians 5:21. not a reference to two-way reciprocal subordination submission. Submit yourselves to one another where your circumstances call for it. Submit as position of life calls for it, wives, children, servants. Under the word submission, there's genuine obligation, there's yielding to authority, there's obedience, and there's a hierarchy. The word itself literally basically means place under. It carries a hierarchical sense to a point of order.
Anyone else?
Brother Ron, in 1 Timothy 2, verse 11 and verse 12.
Yes, sir.
You know, we're talking about God's order in creation.
Yes.
Does he, in verse 9, when the Apostle Paul starts talking about it, does he have God's order under any consideration, beginning in verse 9 instead of verse 11, verse 12?
Tell me your question again, Todd. I'm sorry.
In verse 11 and verse 12, we're talking about God's order.
Yeah. The role Romans of woman. Learn in silence, but right. I suffer not a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man.
All right, is God's order in consideration at all beginning in verse 9?
How's verse 9 go? Pardon me.
Talks about a woman being adorned in modesty.
Adorning, okay, fine. Well, I think so. You know, when I put up the cultural thing here, as far as one of the basic battles in the church, look out. Okay. This is one of our great battles right here. What area do we have more influence and impact on right now than the concept of modesty? Culture is constantly doing what? Changing the tint in our glasses. So this is one of the areas. So if that's what you're kind of asking about, yeah, modesty you put there. Let's recognize something. Let's recognize, my brothers and sisters, you young folks, you got energy. You got years ahead of us. Here's ahead of you. I'm running out of time. Okay? And you young folks, your energy and your vitality to the Lord's church and the welfare of your souls is so important to each of us. And this is one of the areas that you're called to battle, because the cultural view of modesty constantly changes, and you have to work with biblical principles to try and keep a concept of modesty based upon the Word of God. The one problem in the Lord's church today among our people is, if you ask them to define the word modesty, they would act like there's no definition for the word modesty. And there is a word modesty, and it has to have a definition. Now, I know it's difficult because you have to work out the principles with it. But that's an area. That's an area.
Anyone else?
Ask me a question.
Well, Brother Johnny Elmore has one.
Johnny.
What about Acts where Aquila and Priscilla are named? Usually it's Priscilla and Aquila, but in Acts 18 there where they're teaching, Aquila is named first. Is there significance to that?
Well, I don't know if there's any real significance to that, Johnny, except that I know the setting in which that all took place was a private setting. And, I suspect this lady was she probably knew the book. But the point is, it's in a private setting. Let's face it, we have lots of wonderful, godly sisters that know a lot about the Bible. We got a lot of good, godly women who have given a lot of us, since there's adults in the audience, I'll spell it, D-U-M-B, men. So anyway, the point is, we have lots of godly women who give good advice to a lot of men.
Know the Bible, too.
That's right. That's right. Abigail sure gave David some pretty good advice. But anyway, yeah.
Michael and Mavis.
Now, don't keep asking, because pretty soon I'm going to run out of any answers, and I sure would like to get out of here thinking I knew something.
Just got one. Acts 21, and I guess just to be comprehensive in the study, I've heard this brought up in the past.
The prophetess.
Philip, the evangelist, had five virgin daughters who were prophetesses.
Yeah.
And how does that fit in?
Evidently, there certainly definitely was prophecy, and ladies that prophesied. I think looking at the overall picture, we have to put that in the environment of a private circumstance. The reason I say that is, in 1 Corinthians 11, when it talks about women prophesying, oh, by the way, in 1 Corinthians 11, there's definitely, even though those were ladies were prophets, there's definitely a distinction of male and female, because they had to be what? Covered. So, the reason I would take that and think that we have to put them in a circumstance of privacy is 1 Corinthians 14, where the women were not to, in the assembly, they were not to prophesy, etc. Now, so are we going to say that Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 then corrects himself in 1 Corinthians 14? I think we'd have to say 1 Corinthians 14 certainly has to have something to do with what we permit in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Remember something about the Bible. The Bible is a progressive revelation. It's a progressive revelation. But you'll never find in the Bible where an apostle teaches one thing and later on in the same Bible has to correct himself. There's a difference between progressive revelation and a guy writing something and say, oh yeah, I better straighten that out. That's one of the things why we love the Bible. That's one of its proofs of being the Word of God and not the Word of men. Does that help, Mike? Did I? Okay. Sure.
Anyone else? Floor's yours.
Ask me a question, Mike. Ask me a question about 1 Timothy 2.
Would you like to speak on 1 Timothy 2?
Can I say something about 1 Timothy 2? I want to leave this, especially with you young people. Okay, come on, Ron. Give it the program. Oh. Here we go. 1 Timothy 2:12. The three nominees are: I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise the authority given to a man. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Envelope 2, please. I do not permit a woman to teach error or to exercise authority over the men. I do not permit a woman to teach falsely or to domineer over a man. Number 3, I do not permit a woman to teach in a domineering manner. Which is the winner? It's envelope number 1. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise the authority given to men. Here's why I want to leave this with you. In 1 Timothy 2 and 12, it teaches two particular things restricting ladies. They are not to be teaching basically in a public gathering. We see some other circumstances where they're, but they're not to teach nor to exercise the authority. There are two things taught here. And when some individual begins to tell you that the second one modifies the first one, that's a red flag. That's a red flag. There are two things taught there. And the scholarship that backs it up is tremendous. The two things have to be positive. You can't have one positive and one negative because of that little conjunction. I just thank you, Mike, for asking me that question. I really appreciate it. I really wanted to leave that with this fine audience of young people. This is important. And I'll tell you why. I'm getting a little carried away now. This is important because within the Lord's church, we have people who are trying to take a different position.